You are listening to a sermon by Andrei Pekovich, recorded in three parts on Sunday, December 28, 2014, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Nothing is certain but death and taxes. That was Ben Franklin. Koheleth spends a lot of time throughout Ecclesiastes insisting that we look death in the face as the evil end that it is. You'll find that word, evil end, time and again. The preparations that the Egyptian pharaohs made for life after death were well known around the Middle East, and we can only imagine how they were the subject of much laughter and derision. If you're a god, what are you doing dying? If you're dead, what makes you think? Why make preparations for a life after death? What makes you think you're going to come back to life? But we resist death with every fiber of our being as well. We cling to life as much as we want our next breath of air when we're underwater. Sigmund Freud coined a term for it, thanatophobia, fear of thanatos. Thanatos was the minor Greek god of death. Though anxiety and denial of death is more present in women than in men, both cope in different ways. Men, you'll often find, who stray from their wives will scatter progeny around the globe, it's said, in a vain attempt to avoid death or deny death. We have hundreds of sayings advising us how to avoid death. Never place a broom on a bed. Close umbrellas before bringing them into the house. Keep cast off piano keys. Never rock an empty rocking chair. If you see a will-o'-the-wisp out walking at night, turn your coat inside out. Never serve 13 at a table. Never cross knives while setting a table. If you hear a dog howl at night, reach under the bed and turn over a shoe. Don't look into a mirror over another's shoulder. There are hundreds of these. I had to laugh when I was looking at some of them, thinking, gosh, is there nothing else we have to do but fear death all the time? But they arose at a time when death was ever present, when our young children would die, early and often. Some of us can't resist offering advice, even after we've passed on, about how to avoid death or meet it. There are cemeteries all over the world that have tombstones bearing this particular epitaph. Remember, friend, when passing by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you will be. So prepare for death and follow me. It dates back hundreds of years. And there are some who can't be content without adding the reply, to follow you, I'm not content until I know which way you went. But just like that inscription on the tombstone, I'm not sure our society treats death with its proper respect, its proper due. We try to avoid it as much as possible. We've achieved a schizophrenic split in our society. We view the body and the soul as two parts of the whole. But we place considerable emphasis on those different parts. We say the body dies and the soul survives. This is not scriptural. Nephesh is the Hebrew word for soul, and it's sometimes translated as creature. And it's an integrated object. You cannot separate the soul from the body. It's all one. Nephesh also refers to living creatures, all living creatures, animals, creatures of the air, creatures of the sea, creatures of the ground, they're all souls. They do not have souls, they are souls. We in our modern parlance have divided that, but it's not scriptural. Our soul does indeed die. It's mortal. Ezekiel 18:4 tells us this. Know that all lives are mine, the lives of the parent, the life of the parent as well as the life of the child. It is only the person who sins that shall die. And the word person there is given as soul. The whole book of Job is also an investigation into the nature of good and evil, but also the nature and reason for death, because so much death happens in that book. Daniel 2 discusses death, its purpose and meaning. Daniel 12:2, many of those who sleep in the dust of earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. This is where we get the first hints of a life after death. It's also the inspiration for John's vision in Revelation, which Rosie told us much about the other day. The New Testament does not contradict this. Hebrews 9:27, just as man is destined to die once, and after that to face judgment. And James says a similar thing, James 4:14. Yet you do not even know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. So when we come to Ecclesiastes, you'll find it's perfectly in keeping with those other scriptures. It's not a disappointing book. It's simply reflecting what's already been said elsewhere. Ecclesiastes 3:2, a time to be born and a time to die. Ecclesiastes 9:2, everything that confronts them is vanity, since the same fate comes to all, to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to those who sacrifice and those who do not sacrifice. Ecclesiastes 9:5, the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward, and even the memory of them is lost. And verse 6, their love, their hate, their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. So we should not hurry past death. We shouldn't wallow in it. But if we do not seek some aspect of death often in parts of our lives, then our spice for living can be lost. Yet so often we try to eliminate death from our thinking. We have sayings like, it's too morbid, I won't consider that, or why consider death when we have so many things to live for? Some of us use sayings to minimize the pain of loss and death. They'll say things like, when your time is up, God will take you home. That may be appropriate when we're dying of old age at 80, surrounded by our family, but it's not really appropriate when we're talking about a young child killed in an accident or a young soldier at war. So Koheleth asks us not to hurry past death as a fleeting or transitory thing. Give death its due. Part 2, life is not fair. We are highly resistant to believing that. We live in a world in which cause and effect are visibly connected. If we work hard, we will be successful. If we do well in school, we will get a good job. If we're faithful and loving, we'll have a good marriage. If we raise our kids well, they will be successes themselves and turn out as good adults. If we vote, we'll get good governance. The promise of control and predictability is seductive, even in our churches. Pray the right way, and you'll get a blessing. We act as if we can be in control of everything. Our health, our wealth, our marriage, our job, our career, our kids, our church, our friends. We have certainty about so many things, so it's a shock when things happen that are beyond our control. Ecclesiastes 9, verses 1 to 6. All this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, one does not know. Everything that confronts them is vanity, since the same fate comes to all, to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to those who sacrifice and those who do not sacrifice. As are the good, so are the sinners. Those who swear are like those who shun an oath. This is an evil in all that happens under the sun, that the same fate comes to everyone. Moreover, the hearts of all are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But whoever is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. The living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward, and even the memory of them is lost. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished. Never again will they have any share in all that happens under the sun. Verses 11 and 12 also speak to this. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the skillful, but time and chance happen to them all. For no one can anticipate the time of disaster. Like fish taken in a cruel net, and like birds caught in a snare, so mortals are snared at a time of calamity when it suddenly falls upon them. How can this be true? I'll tell you a little parable about power and control. In 1923, a small group of the world's wealthiest men met at the Edgewood Beach Hotel in Chicago. At the time, these men controlled more money than the U.S. Treasury had. Their meeting was said to have been both a celebration of their exploits and plans for future domination. They were captains of their respective industries, from steel to wheat, from brokerages to banks, and they were some of the most successful businessmen of their era. Of those 9 men present at that meeting, in a few years, 3 died broke, 2 died shortly after being released from prison, 1 lived the remainder of his life in an asylum, and 2 committed suicide. Time and chance happened to them all. When I was growing up, it was apparent that life wasn't fair, and my favorite target of the day was Murray Pezum. Anybody remember Murray Pezum? Anybody still have a Pez dispenser? He was a Sharpie, a shyster, I thought, but he was a mining promoter. He salted mines and ripped off investors. He served a little time in jail, promoted more mines, but he did raise a lot of money for business. He owned the BC Lions. He started a number of small businesses. He raised a son who became a well-known surgeon, but then he divorced his 3rd wife to marry a 21-year-old blonde bombshell who he then turned into a broker. That was when he was in his 70s. He died happy. He told Vancouver columnist David Baines, who I respect intensely, "David, I've lived a full life. I've done everything I want. I can't say God has been bad to me, but I can yell at him sometimes. Who am I to judge? Did I know the real Murray Pezum? Not really. We can all fall prey to bad judgment at times, and it's easy to do so. So I'll tell you a humorous little story. See if I get this one right. 3 men were standing in line to get into heaven one day, and apparently it had been a busy day, so St. Peter had to tell the first one, "Heaven's pretty busy today, and I've only been asked to admit people for now that have had particularly horrible deaths. So what's your story?" And the first man says, "Well, for a while I suspected my wife was cheating on me, and I came home early to try to catch her red-handed. And I came into my apartment on the 25th floor of our building, and I was looking around because I could tell something was wrong, but I didn't know what. I couldn't find anybody. Finally, I went out to the balcony and I saw this guy hanging off the railing 25 stories above the ground, and I thought, aha! So I started kicking and hammering at his hands, and he hung on for a while, and then I got a hammer and bashed on his fingers, and he let go and he fell into some bushes, but he wasn't dead after 25 stories. And I was just furious. I couldn't stand it anymore, so I ran into the kitchen, pushed the fridge out to the edge of the balcony, and tipped it over the railing, and it fell on him, killing him instantly." St. Peter says, "Whoa, you're not the kind of guy we normally live in here, but that was pretty bad. So what happened next?" "Well, I had a heart attack and died right there on the balcony, flumped over the edge." St. Peter said, "Okay, well, not usual, but we'll let you in." Second man comes up and St. Peter says, "Heaven's still busy. What's your story?" It's been a strange day. You see, I was on the 26th floor of my apartment, and I usually do my exercises out there, and today somehow I slipped and fell over the edge. And I managed to grab onto the railing of the apartment below me, and I was screaming for somebody to help, and nobody came. And then all of a sudden the guy came out, and I thought, oh, he heard me, I'm saved. But he starts kicking at my fingers, and then he bashes my fingers with a hammer, and I fell into some bushes. I thought I was going to be okay, because I was still alive. I thought, oh, I'm injured, but I'm going to be alive. And all of a sudden this fridge comes out of the sky and crashes on me. And that's why I'm here. And St. Peter said, oh, okay, well, you can go in. Third man comes to the front of the line. St. Peter says, "You know, heaven's still busy. Only horrible deaths. What happened?" "Picture this," the guy says. "I'm hiding naked in a refrigerator." We all have judgments. They're usually wrong. We as a race like to invent moral authority, though. We have referees for our sports games. We have courtrooms full of judges. We think if we play by the rules, which should be as obvious to anyone as they are to us, that we'll be treated well and fairly. Raindrops would only fall on bad people. Wars would never kill any innocents. There's a reason that Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry is so popular. We like to think that way. We all have this innate sense of right and wrong, which comes with its own ready-made desire to be judged. We wish to prove ourselves, to justify ourselves, and are only too ready to ask after telling our story, well, what would you have done in my place? Unitarian minister Peter Fleck tells of a drama he saw on television one day. A man dies and finds himself standing in line in front of a bored usher at the gates to heaven. The usher tells him he can choose either the door on the right, which leads to heaven, or the door on the left, which leads to hell. The man says, you mean I can choose either one? Usher said, yeah, that's right. Now move along. Keep moving. People are lining up behind you. Just choose one and keep the line moving. But I want to confess. I want to come clean. I want to be judged, he says. We don't have time for that, says the usher. Just choose a door and move along. The man chooses the door on the left, leading to hell. Fleck's conclusion is that, in the end, we want to be judged, we want to be held accountable, and ultimately, we want to be forgiven. We have our own innate sense of fairness that rarely, if ever, leaves us, because we want life to be fair. And Koheleth tells us life is not fair. Let me come back to nephesh again, the soul that all beings are. Charles Darwin was once asked if there was anything unique about being human. He answered, man is the only animal that blushes. And then Mark Twain said, man is the only animal that needs to blush. What is blushing, though? It's an expression of self-consciousness, of knowing that we're being watched and held to standards. When Adam and Eve first ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they found clothing for themselves and hid from the Lord, saying, we were naked. Their consciousness had become self-consciousness. We live our lives out of standards that we can never hope to meet. We live in a world that can never hope to meet our standards. And we live under a God who tells us not to worry about it. It's his job. Part 3. You are still free. You simply have to realize it. So, the meat of our talk today should build on verses 11 and 12. It's not the key phrase, but it's 11 and 12 is where I think this starts. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the skillful, but time and chance happen to them all. For no one can anticipate the time of disaster. It looks like a no-win situation. How can it offer us freedom? It reminds me of those early days in engineering school when I was learning the three laws of thermodynamics, and you don't need to know what those are, but it's how they were translated. Somebody translated them for us. He says, essentially, the first law is you can't win, the second law is you can't break even, and the third law is you can't get out of the game. Now, it's mathematical, but that's how I always remembered them. The laws actually have theological implications far beyond physics and engineering. Many of us have situations in life where we can't win, break even, or get out of the game. Some of us have family relationships that are so dysfunctional, you feel like only you can win or lose, even though that's not how families are supposed to be. But you can never win because the other isn't ever playing by the rules. You can't get fair treatment because in family disputes there's no referee. And no matter how hard you try, you can't leave family. They're always with you. So you can't get out of the game. So what are we supposed to do with our lives? Koheleth has an answer for us. He's already told us this answer 4 times in the book by this point, and he's going to tell us 2 more times after this. But here's the most succinct, the most effective, the most complete passage. It's verses 7 to 10. Go, eat your bread with enjoyment, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has long ago approved of what you do. Let your garments always be white. Do not let oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that are given to you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought, or knowledge, or wisdom in Sheol to which you were going. By the way, here, Sheol means the grave. It doesn't mean hell, as we've often been led to believe. When you don't have choices, when you don't have any way of getting out of the game, never mind winning, when others, whether they be parents or kids or coworkers, friends or neighbors, don't recognize the contribution you make to them, when your efforts are in vain, when you've lived your life by the expectations of others and find yourself at 30 or 50 or 70 with your dreams unfulfilled, when the knowledge of your own mortality strikes late at night during sleepless nights in bed, what do you do? This passage gives you something else. It gives you the freedom to pursue what you're already doing without any worry about success or failure. I titled today's service Carpe Diem from the quotation by the Roman poet Horace. He had considerable wisdom for his day, and he penned them in his odes. The whole passage containing this phrase goes like this. Whether Jupiter has allotted you many more winters or only this one, be wise, be truthful, strain the wine, and scale back your long hopes to a short period. While we speak, envious time will have already fled. Seize the day, trusting as little as possible in the next day. Carpe diem, quam minimum credula postero, seize the day, trusting as little as possible in the next. He had lots of other good advice for us. We can go over some of that later if we want. There are many classical phrases which serve to remind us that we may plan for a long life, but we should live as though we had a short one. And we should celebrate as often as possible. My sister Martine has a rare form of MS and lives her life quite differently than I do. When she was first diagnosed about 10 years ago, she was given 5 years to live, and she recognized her death would not only affect her profoundly, but also her kids, her husband, her family, her friends. But she concluded there was nothing she could do to change the outcome, so she simply did her best. She continued teaching and consulted traditional and alternative healers, did her work with all her heart, and enjoyed her life as well. She tried to reduce her stress, but life happened anyway. Illness and kids, breakup and divorce, she lost her good rental house. But she not only coped with it and blossomed, and it's 5 years after she was supposed to have died. She has not been healed, but she's outlived all expectations. I've never asked her what makes her live her life that way, but I suspect I'd get the answer, carpe diem. John McNeil, who's a gay Jesuit priest and theologian at Union Theological in New York, says of a friend, "I once knew a brother student who dreamed that in a month's time he would die. He dreamt it 3 times over one night, and though he was as matter-of-fact and prosaic as you might understand, that dream simply stuck to him and he couldn't get rid of it. Now people would say that stopped that man's work, that he simply sat and moped, called the doctor, and shut himself in. But he did no such thing. He never put in such a month's work in the district where he was a missionary, never. It was a pity the vision faded away. It was a pity that the vision should fade away from any of us. It did him no harm. He never had such a month of personal holiness and such a month of self-sacrifice, doing things with all his might, both secular and sacred. For he had only a month, and then it was the judgment seat. Thus it always comes out, whatever way you like to turn, the great lesson from eternity is, be diligent and make the most of your passing day for yourself, for your character, for your neighbor, for your God, for it will all meet you and be part and parcel of you through eternity. This is the true philosophy of Carpe Diem." That was John McNeil. Many years ago, I studied a variety of philosophies and religions, including Zen Buddhism and existentialism. It was an appropriate time in my life to do so. I'd sort of been disabused of the notion that the world owed me a living by that point, but I was casting about for how I could make a contribution to the world. And Zen turned out to be a useful practice to follow daily. Imagine ruminating on this koan. What is the sound of one hand clapping? You can think about it for a few seconds, or a few minutes, or a few hours, a few days. The answer, there's at least one answer, and probably more, but the answer won't profit you anything. It's the practice that has the value. And Zen gave me a discipline and persistence that I lacked. In existentialism, which I studied at university, I glimpsed that one might have a successful life no matter what circumstances might occur. It's a personal philosophy generally considered to have been set forth by Soren Kierkegaard. He proposed that each individual, not society and not religion, each individual is solely responsible for giving meaning to life and for living it passionately and authentically. You can imagine how that went over in mainline churches. Albert Camus was one of the foremost existential writers of his time. His novel, The Stranger, follows a young man, a young Frenchman living a wasted life in Algeria. He gets caught up in a violent mob and kills a man. He's immediately captured, tried, and sentenced to death. And he goes through many stages of anger and despair, bargaining, resignation, acceptance. And finally, he comes to a fierce joy as he is sentenced to hang for his crime. How could the circumstances be any worse? How could he come to joy? Through a pointless, foolish act, he's had everything of value taken from him, and he's about to lose his life. But in the last few minutes of his life, he learns how to embrace life fully, and he finds a redemption in that. I still remember the last passage of the book in which the young man is still thinking to himself, "For all to be accomplished, for me to feel less lonely, all that remained to hope was on the day of my execution, there should be a huge crowd of spectators, and they should greet me with howls of execration." In this way, even in one's death, one can be an example to others. And some years later, I found this philosophy was summed up best in a seminar I took in which the leader said, "The only true freedom lies in having no choice. Do what you said you were going to do simply because you chose it." So out of that, in my earlier practices, I found my value to others. I learned that I simply had to decide to do so, to choose to do so, and to leave myself no choice. I learned to make promises and to keep them. I learned when not to make promises. I learned to stop worrying about what others would think, and I found more freedom to make promises that I could keep. And I kept these promises simply because I gave myself no choice. And somehow that seems appropriate because Kohelet tells us the same thing. Life gives you no choice. Verse 10. "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going." Always I wondered about which career to pursue, and when I stopped chasing after the first perfect career or the job that would pay me more, give me more prestige, when I simply contributed to the good job that I was in, I found more freedom to be a good worker. When I wondered best how to accumulate wealth and struggled to become rich, thinking that would give me happiness, I found equal measures of satisfaction and dissatisfaction. Freedom of working two jobs was satisfying, but the freedom to spend money, that wasn't so much. For years, I wondered how to pick which woman to marry. When I finally picked a woman, there was no wondering about how it was done. There was only the moment of choice, like stepping off a diving board. The only freedom was in having no choice. And that's the key meaning behind the verse of scripture for today that I consider most important. Go, eat your bread with enjoyment. Drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has long ago approved of what you do. Let your garments always be white. Do not let oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your life that are given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. Daryl Dash, who's a Waterloo grad and a church planter in Toronto, has a blog on life, the church, and everything, in which he dispenses measures of wisdom and fascinating vignettes on life. I put a link in your bulletin so you can follow it up later. I think he writes well. On his blog, I found a poem by Jewish-American poet Eve Merriam. I'm just curious. Everywhere I go, I find Jewish writers seem to be most comfortable with paradox. You know, it's Harold Kushner, you know, Abraham Heschel, Martin Buber. They seem to deal with paradox in a way that I can understand. I really appreciate that. Anyway, Eve Merriam, her poem was about the enjoyment of poetry, but I find it has a sentiment that's universal in experience. Don't be bashful. Bite in. Pick it up with your fingers and let the juice that may run down your chin. Life is ready and ripe now, wherever you are, whenever you are. You don't need a knife or fork or spoon or napkin or tablecloth. For there is no core or stem or rind or pit or seed or skin to throw away.